Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. It was the end of summer, late August 2012. Bob Ritchie was a recent college grad with a degree in music education. He had just finished a triathlon in New Jersey, and then he headed to the beach in Atlantic City to meet up with a bunch of friends.
We were at the beach, I would say 5 minutes, five, ten minutes, when I've done what I would imagine many listeners and probably millions of people do across the world.
Bob ran down the beach and dove into an ocean wave about waist deep.
And when I made that particular dive, I happened to look back at a friend who was behind me and sort of looked down and back at him from sort of under my armpit, if that makes sense, since I had my arms outstretched ahead of me. And that, you know, that just put me in an awkward, less than ideal position, I guess, to put it mildly.
Bob hit the ocean floor and broke two vertebrae in his neck.
My immediate sensation was one of confusion because I hit the water and I went to, you know, stand up as one does, and I couldn't move and I was stuck face down. I actually happened to be floating in the water, but I actually wasn't sure where I was in space.
A friend spotted Bob floating motionlessly and realized something was very wrong. He turned him over, and then lifeguards rescued him from the water. Bob spent 10 days in the ICU, and he was eventually transferred to McGee Rehabilitation Hospital in Philadelphia.
I have complete paralysis in all 10 fingers, partial wrist function, partial function of my arms, and then complete paralysis from the chest down.
One part of the rehab process was to get Bob moving again, now with the help of a power wheelchair. He says it was all very overwhelming.
Your whole life is turned upside down. You know, it goes without saying when you suffer a catastrophic injury and, you know, you're put in one wheelchair for a couple days and then you're put in a different one and they ask you, you know, well, you know, how does this one feel compared to the last one? And for me, the response was always, oh, I mean, feels different. I don't know if it feels better or worse.
But it was the only way Bob was going to be mobile at all from now on. He tried four different models.
And then from there, a couple different seat cushions, a couple different backrests to get you to a place where you're not only going to be comfortable throughout the day, but you're also going to be safe and healthy.
Eventually, he found a power wheelchair that's right for him.
It's my primary means of mobility. From the time I get up to the time I go to bed.
He's able to drive again, using the chair as a driver's seat in a custom van. It goes everywhere Bob goes.
It is something that I'm somewhat maybe protective over. I don't like people touching the chair, you know, leaning on it, messing with it in any way. It also does feel like an invasion of personal space.
When medical equipment, like a power wheelchair, is an absolute necessity, the only way you can keep moving, keep going, it takes on an outsized role. It has to fit right, work right, or the consequences will be grave. And often, this equipment is expensive and access is a problem. On today's show, navigating life in new ways and the gear that makes it possible. First up, it started in 2014 when a dare turned into a global movement. Florida pro golfer Chris Kennedy recorded himself pouring a bucket of ice water over his head. And he challenged several others to do the same within 24 hours. If not, they had to make a $100 donation to an ALS organization.
4 hours to respond, you're going to donate $100 to the
Pete Freights, a former Boston College baseball star who had been diagnosed with ALS, heard about the challenge and started promoting it. The rest is viral history. You remember this? The challenge quickly became a feel-good way to fight a devastating disease. ALS stands for amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. It attacks the nervous system, and patients gradually lose all motor function. Celebrities got in on the challenge, politicians. Lots of people doused themselves with ice water and made a donation anyway. It raised $115 million that summer.
That's double the ALS Association's typical annual fundraising revenue.
That's Emily Haynes. She's a reporter with the Chronicle of Philanthropy.
And to have done it almost accidentally through this viral campaign is, I mean, it's pretty unheard of.
The ALS Association was never able to replicate this kind of enthusiasm or level of giving in the following years. But that first incredible downpour of millions of dollars is still having a big impact beyond the way people had first envisioned. Jad Slaman found out how.
The mission of the Ice Bucket Challenge was to raise money for research that would eventually lead to a cure for ALS. And Emily Haynes from the Chronicle of Philanthropy tells me that huge influx of cash was generally well spent. $80 million went straight to research. There are now more clinical trials for ALS than ever before.
But just to give you a sense of the cost of that research, it takes roughly $2 billion to take just one treatment from the research stage to the market stage. So, you know, all of the money raised from the Ice Bucket Challenge, that $115 million, that's not enough to fully fund even one treatment.
I took a look at where the science on ALS stands. Researchers are excited about genetic markers they've identified as associated with ALS, though it's not a genetic disease. It's a breakthrough people credit to the Ice Bucket Challenge, but a cure still seems a long, long way away. And realistically, most people who have ALS don't have time to wait. The illness is progressive and aggressive. Patients typically die within a few years of diagnosis. Emily says this led to a bit of a conundrum when it came to spending all this money.
There is tension in terms of whether the ALS Association should be using this windfall to support patients living with the disease versus researching a cure. So there's kind of like, do we focus our efforts on eliminating the problem or on kind of ameliorating the problem?
A cure or comfort? Emily sees the merit of both sides. It's an unfortunate, ruthless, statistical reality that most of those diagnosed with ALS at the time of the famous challenge have since passed away. Pete Freights, one of the main forces promoting the challenge, died in 2019. Most ALS patients don't have time to wait for a cure, a big breakthrough, but in the meantime, they still have urgent needs.
If you think about somebody's progression with the disease, they might first need a cane, but then they might need something more substantial like a walker. So the cane might come back, they move to a walker, they might then lead to a scooter, that might then lead to a power wheelchair.
That's Jennifer Jelly, who was head of the ALS Association Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota chapter during the famous Ice Bucket Challenge year. The progression from cane to walker to wheelchair can happen very quickly, which leaves patients in a lurch.
Oftentimes, people don't need that piece of equipment for a long period of time. And how our insurance system works, like, you often can't get multiple pieces of equipment covered.
Local ALS chapters like Jennifer's have equipment that they loan out to families.
We want you to have what you need when you need it.
But those items are expensive. There were wait lists, each name representing a desperate person basically trapped in their body. Then the donations started coming in. After the lion's share of Ice Bucket Challenge money went to the national organization earmarked for research, the rest, tens of millions of dollars, went to these regional chapters.
But we went from literally like 20 donations in July to thousands in August. I'll never forget our office manager coming into my office, and she had a stack of mail about a foot high. And she said to me, she's like, I just want you to see this because normally this stack is about an inch high in a day. And it was a foot high. And that was just one day's mail.
Basically, everyone knew where the money should go almost immediately. The equipment loan pool.
I will tell you, the team that called all the families that were waiting for pieces of equipment to tell them, look, we know you've been waiting for this. We've purchased you a new one. It'll be here on this date. It was like being Santa Claus on Christmas morning. It was a game changer.
8 years after an Ice Bucket Challenge no one could replicate, still years away from anything like a cure, they have this one enduring victory. No more wait list.
We haven't had a wait list since. And that is a really big deal for people living with ALS, and a huge testament to the power of that movement.
The existence of this loan program and the reason why tens of millions of dollars went to medical equipment instead of a cure is, well, Medicare. The tedious insurance rules and regulations around what gets paid for and when.
The original reason that the loan program started was because Medicare wouldn't cover bathroom equipment.
We're talking bath chairs, toilet seat risers.
Those pieces of equipment were deemed luxury items. So that is why that was the original start of the program, which still blows my mind to this day.
It's an onerous system to navigate to get this kind of stuff paid for. One of the most common things on the wish list is one of the most expensive, power wheelchairs. They can run tens of thousands of dollars, a ticket price way too high to pay out of pocket for most.
It's unfortunate conversations I have every day in clinic when I evaluate someone and they say, okay, when can I pick up my chair? And I'm like, it's going to be about 3 months. And then they're dumbfounded.
Mark Schmeller is an assistant professor at the School of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences at the University of Pittsburgh. He says the case of ALS illustrates a problem all people who rely on power wheelchairs face, just in a very acute way.
Medicare policy clearly states that you can only get what you need when you need it. And sadly, everybody knows if we can wait this out, if we can throw barriers to this, you know, eventually they're not going to need it because they're not with us anymore. And it's a really sad tactic, I think.
The reality is someone with ALS may only have a few months where a power wheelchair will do them any good before the disease makes them unable to use one and instead forces them into a medical bed. So how can something as critical as a power wheelchair be so hard to get?
About 15, 20 years ago, there was just rampant waste, fraud, and abuse occurring.
It started with these late-night commercials. You may have heard them.
Hey, Bernice and Joy, tell everyone which power wheelchair got you to the Grand Canyon.
That's just one example. Can't walk that far or fast anymore? Need help getting from point A to B? No problem. These commercials said you probably qualified for one of these fancy chairs. Call this 1-800 number. And a lot of people did just that.
And the utilization by Medicare, for example, went from spending about $200 and maybe $300 million a year on basic power wheelchairs and scooters to over $1 billion.
The problem was these mobility scooters were being marketed as a convenient way to get around for people who could use some help, as opposed to medical equipment for those who couldn't get around at all without them. So people who didn't really need them got them anyway, with Medicare footing the bill. And a lot of middlemen got rich in the process. Some even shadier actors were simply billing for chairs that never got to anyone. It was just too easy to get the government to pay for these things. These mobility scooters are a lot like the ones you might see at a Walmart. Nothing nearly as complicated as the stuff an ALS patient might need, but to regulators, that didn't matter. Regulations for complex power chairs were tightened the same time as regulations for your off-the-shelf plain Jane variety.
The complex wheelchairs were just collateral damage because of the late-night TV. We were not the ones committing fraud.
Power wheelchairs have to fit their specific user. Some chairs are guided by joystick, others by mouth, a sip and puff method. Some can stand up, they can tilt or recline this way or that to avoid pressure injuries. They all need repairs and maintenance. So these chairs are a big investment. And they have a limited lifespan because they're tailored to the needs of one user. As I was writing this story, I passed a power chair on the curb, ready to be taken with the house trash and the recycling.
The supplier doesn't want to take it back because it's customized to an individual. So the family, you know, wants to get rid of it. And their insurance is most likely paid for the device, but there's really no secondary market.
So amid shortages and waitlist, a lot of power chairs, their owners recovered or more likely passed on, they just sit idle, fonts of tough memories stashed away in garages or basements. The Ice Bucket Challenge solved this big issue for the thousands of Americans living with ALS, but many thousands more, people with spinal injuries, other neurologic diseases, they remain waitlisted. No viral campaign came to their rescue.
Well, people only know it's a problem when they need it. So if I'm talking to someone, you know, just a common person, or even sometimes talking with legislators or policymakers, they may not want to take the time to hear what we're saying.
Like ALS itself, an extremely rare disease, access to power wheelchairs is an easy problem to ignore. That is, when it's not your problem.
That was Chad Slaman reporting. We just heard about long wait lists for power wheelchairs, and that's something Bob Ritchie mentioned as well. He's been using a power wheelchair since he had an accident at the Jersey Shore. After using his chair for 9 years, the bottom frame cracked, so it was time for a replacement.
For me, the two challenges were waiting for an appointment and then waiting for the chair itself.
He said start to finish, it took him about a year to get a new chair. He had to get the replacement approved by his insurance company and then get fitted for it. At one point, he had to reschedule an appointment because of COVID, and it took months to get another one.
You know, even close family are shocked and horrified when they find out that, you know, this process will take, in the best of circumstances, 4 months, maybe. I think that's about as fast as it could possibly go. Without the use of a wheelchair, I'm completely bedridden.
Thankfully, Bob could still use his old chair to get around in the meantime. And a few weeks ago, he finally got his new wheels.
I'm fortunate to have good insurance, but the sticker price on the new chair that I just received is $40,000.
Coming up, getting used to a high-tech new limb requires patience.
The trick is to grab a chip without destroying it out of the bag.
That's still to come on The Pulse.
The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're hearing stories about living with medical equipment, people who rely on gear to get around and keep going. artificial limbs are becoming more and more sophisticated. A few years ago, I had a chance to go along to a prosthetics therapy appointment with Brian Sims at a place called Advanced Arm Dynamics in Philadelphia. Brian had lost his left hand in a work accident, and he was learning how to use a new high-tech limb.
I'm left-hand dominant, so it's been a real crazy journey for me. I'm a father of four. I also am a volunteer firefighter.
What am I hearing?
I used to talk with my hands a lot, so apparently I still do that a lot. So the noise that you're hearing is my hand open and closing.
Oh, let me hear that.
And you hear the beeps. The beeps is the change of a function.
The hand has a thick plastic covering. Picture a milky white rubber glove. The model is called the Michelangelo. It can move the thumb, the middle, and the index fingers. Brian has about half of his forearm left. That sits in a hard plastic sleeve custom made for him, and the hand attaches to that. Since getting this new limb, Brian has had to slowly relearn many of the basic skills of everyday life, like writing.
And every chance that I get, you know, I'm always finding myself doodling on paper, just as, you know, always keeping sharp, you know, trying to write my name. So I'm attempting to write it in cursive. A little nervous. My name is Brian. So B-R-I-A-N and Sims, S-I-M-S.
Yeah, if you were to close it, Brian, you could show, Okay. Actually real quick, just to see.
The hand is myoelectric, meaning it picks up electric signals that come from Brian's muscles in his forearm.
So you're using your muscles to control the rate and the speed at which the hand opens and closes and turns the wrist, but he...
That's Chris Bollinger. He is a clinical therapy specialist who'd been working with Brian for over a year at that point.
So Brian still feels his phantom hand, and sometimes actually experiences phantom pain as well. For some individuals, they actually are moving their phantom hand. They're actually closing their hand, which triggers your inside flexor muscles. He can show you now. You see how well it's isolated.
Brian takes the prosthetic limb off, and he thinks about using his hand.
This is making a fist or closing my hand.
I can see his arm muscles twitch.
That's opening my hand.
When he slips the sleeve with the hand back onto his forearm, sensors on the inside receive signals from his muscles and make the hand move.
I could pretty much do any basic task.
Brian carefully opens a small bag of chips.
The trick is to grab a chip without destroying it out of the bag.
The first few crumble, but then he gets one without crushing it.
I can open up a water bottle.
His therapist, Chris, says all of these things are hard-earned victories because Brian cannot feel anything that he touches. His hand doesn't send signals back to his brain.
You rely on feel for everything. Opening up that water bottle, a new user, I would not practice that task with because they don't know exactly the strength at which they're grabbing that yet.
Given that the hand doesn't feel anything, Brian often uses a different attachment that's shaped like a hook and can grab things, like a pair of tongs. It gets a better grip.
If I'm doing stuff, I like the hook.
But new advances are happening rapidly with prosthetic devices that are directly controlled by the brain and that offer sensation.
For me to change thumb positions is that I hold open.
Brian Sims is keeping an eye on all of these new developments, but he's happy with the hand he has now. And his kids think he's the coolest guy ever. They gave him a new nickname, Skill, because of his ability to overcome challenges.
They don't even call me Dad. Half the time they're like, Skill, come here.
When someone needs a prosthetic limb, they have several important decisions to make. What kind of prosthesis works best for their lifestyle? And who will help them choose the best option and teach them how to use it? If you think about all the things Brian was working on in his appointment, opening bags, opening water bottles, writing, that's a lot to learn. The healthcare professionals who do that work become almost as important in a patient's life as the new limb itself. So when something threatens to change that relationship, people get nervous. Alan Yu has more.
In 2010, when Ed Nathan was in his 50s, a muscle at the back of his leg locked up. It meant that his ankle could not move properly.
Kept walking on the ankle and basically turned the bones of the ankle into gravel.
He broke his ankle without knowing it. Ed has a rare disorder that affects his feet, which damages the nerve connecting his brain and spinal cord to muscles and the cells that detect pain. He did not feel the pain, and it was too late for his ankle.
And while the doctor said they could fuse the bones and use external fixation to try to repair it, they said it would never work again well, and I'd probably have some pain despite the neuropathy.
He decided to go with another option. Amputate and learn to live with a prosthetic. Picking the right prosthetic takes a lot of time and research.
When you're at that point where you've just lost a limb or worse, it's like drinking from a fire hose. There's just so much information coming your way.
But there is someone to help people through that process, a prosthetist. They look at a patient's situation and also how active they want to be with the prosthetic. For instance, someone who wants to run every day will get a different kind of prosthetic than someone who mostly walks around their home. Ed says the prosthetist becomes a really important person in your life.
It's personal. You really do build a relationship, and changing prosthetists is emotionally difficult unless you're having a problem with the one you're leaving. So I know people whose prosthetist retired and they're at wit's end where to go because nobody else knows their case that well, and it's hard to make the change.
This is not like any other healthcare service where you have to pay per visit.
You buy a leg, you get a leg, and you can see them as many times as you need to. So if I have to be there three times a week in a week and they have the schedule availability for me to come in, I'll go in there and I won't get charged for it.
Patients sometimes need adjustments. For example, Ed recently got ill and lost a bit of weight. The weight loss shrunk his stump, the part of his leg that fits into the prosthetic, and the prosthetic no longer fit him very well.
It felt higher on that side, like you put on a new pair of shoes that have a little more heel or something. Yeah, so you can definitely feel it.
If he had kept walking with uneven height in his legs, it could lead to his weight being unevenly distributed, and later on, back pain.
I'd like to start with looking at your measurements compared to...
So Ed's prosthetist, Taffy Bowman, measured the change and adjusted the prosthetic, added some extra material to make it a little longer.
It's like putting a puzzle together. You have to find those right puzzle pieces to make it all fit in the right length.
Ed tried walking with his adjusted prosthetic.
Let's have you walk a little bit. I'll have to turn around and face the mirror again for me. Equal weight on both feet, best you can.
Okay, feels good.
Taffy has been Ed's prosthetist for 7 years. She works at a clinic called Ability Prosthetics and Orthotics near Philadelphia. Ed likes the clinic a lot. He knows the people who manage it by now, and he runs a patient advisory council for them. The prosthetist-patient relationship is important because finding the right person can mean the difference between a good or ill-fitting prosthetic. A few years ago, Mary White lost a leg in a motorcycle accident. She had to search far and wide to find the right prosthetist, something her orthopedic surgeon told her was very important.
You need to find a prosthetist who can hit the bullseye every single time, or you're just not going to have a prosthesis that's consistently comfortable.
Mary lives in a rural part of northern New Hampshire, and she drove for hours to try out several prosthetists. The first clinic did not feel professional to her. She got prosthetics fitted at the next two clinics she tried, but those were not quite right for her.
The first day when I walked out with that system, I had on several ply of prosthetic socks, and those are literally socks that go over your residual limb to kind of act as a buffer. And it would be kind of like going into a shoe store and having the shoe salesperson come to you with a pair of shoes. You try it on, you say, gee, this doesn't really fit. And having them give you several pairs of additional socks and say, well, put these on and it'll eventually fit.
Poorly fitted prosthetics can lead to uneven weight distribution, which could cause pain in the hips or other parts of the body that compensate. The prosthetist she ended up going with is 4.5 hours away from her.
But I will tell you, it's worth every minute in the car to get there.
Given how important these relationships are to patients, changes in the industry are cause for concern. One recent change is that companies that manufacture prosthetics are also buying the clinics that serve patients. A leading manufacturer bought one of the clinics Mary tried in her quest for a prosthetist. Another company bought the clinic that Ed goes to. That means the manufacturer is now also a healthcare provider in a position to recommend their own products to patients. And this has Mary and Ed worried for the future.
If all the small practices get gobbled up by these large prosthetic manufacturers, I'm concerned that amputees are going to be at risk of becoming square pegs that are forced to fit into round holes just because this is what they want to recommend as a prosthetic system. And it doesn't always work.
And at some point in the future, will they offer bonuses to prosthetists to push me or patients to products that they manufacture as opposed to competitive products?
Ed has talked to his prosthetist Taffy about this and the executives at the clinic he goes to. He said he trusts them when they say that would never happen.
So I'm not worried about them. It's the next generation that don't have this sense of ownership, and they're just coming out of school, but they didn't build the business. They don't have an emotional stake in the business.
Jeffrey Brand is the founder and chairman of Ability Prosthetics, the clinic Ed goes to. Ottobock, a global prosthetics manufacturer, bought the company in 2020. They own more than 300 clinics. Jeffrey still runs the clinic and tells patients not to worry.
I would say to that patient and any others coming on that they only have upside.
Jeffrey says that being owned by a manufacturer gives the company access to more resources and a larger network of clinics across the US and the world. He said it means his employees can provide better service by learning from more clinics. And this ownership can provide long-term growth. Now Jeffrey can talk about setting up a residency program for students learning to be prosthetists.
Our field has always been, it gets referred to as a cottage industry, mom and pop practices, right? And that's fine, right? To each his own. It had always been my goal to stay away from operating like that.
I contacted Ottobock, the manufacturer that bought Ability Prosthetics, several times. But after our initial exchange, they did not get back to me for an interview. Clinics in the US take these deals for business reasons, explained Eve Lee, executive director of the American Orthotic and Prosthetic Association, which represents prosthetic clinics and manufacturers.
What is driving this is growth in the industry, in the profession, and the patients that we serve. And so in order to continue to be a viable profession, growth has to occur.
Prosthetists used to make custom devices in their own small full-service shops, make the new limb, fit it, and maintain it. But these days, prosthetic devices are more sophisticated. Clinics need to order a lot of different parts that require clinical trials and research before a patient can get them. That sophistication also makes it more expensive and complex to run a clinic now versus a few decades ago. This is the part of the story where normally I would find a relatively impartial expert to comment on this overall trend of manufacturers buying clinics. But it was more difficult than usual to find someone to talk to who had less of a stake one way or the other, because this is a field where everyone knows everyone.
So I used to joke that I could have dropped my last name like Cher or Adele and just gone by Wendy because there is no other Wendy in the field.
Wendy Beatty is an assistant professor of physical medicine and rehabilitation at Northwestern University. Over the course of her career, she has both worked with prosthetics manufacturers on design and practiced at a clinic for more than 2 decades. She says that first of all, it's harder for a clinic to stay in business now than it used to be.
It's not enough to provide fabulous patient care if you can't keep the door is open and the light's on. Reimbursements have decreased, meaning that the money that we get paid from the insurance companies, primarily Medicare, and our costs have only increased. Manufacturing costs have skyrocketed because the cost of shipping, the cost of workers have all skyrocketed in the last few years. I think it's much harder for an individual private practice to be financially stable.
So on the one hand, a clinic that is part of a much larger network has a lot more power to negotiate better deals for patients when it comes to buying parts or insurance payments.
On the other hand, if patients are going to have less options and clinicians are going to have less options regarding what they can fit patients with, I view that as a concern.
Wendy says she has not seen manufacturers limit patient choice after buying clinics in the US, but it could happen. She added that it's an important field to watch right now. One, because this change to the field of prosthetics in the US is new. Also, there is a growing number of COVID-19 patients who have had to amputate limbs because of blood clots, meaning the number of people who are affected by this industry-wide change is only going up.
That story was reported by Alan Yu. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're hearing stories about people who rely on medical equipment and devices to keep them going and how they navigate their relationship with that gear. For Chris Donges, that journey started a few years ago at one of his favorite places. He was at a basketball game in Philadelphia with his girlfriend, Megan Carter. The Sixers were playing the Atlanta Hawks. The game was going okay, but then Chris began to feel very ill.
And I went to get something to eat, and I took like two bites. And I looked at Megan and was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to vomit, essentially. Like I can't keep this down.
Chris felt so sick that he and Megan left the game early and drove to the hospital to figure out what was happening. The doctors ran a few tests, and they came back with a shocking diagnosis, heart failure. Nicole Curry picks up the story from here.
This all happened in 2018, just a few days before Halloween. Chris and Megan were sitting in the hospital room, overwhelmed and unable to make sense of it all.
This is all within a less than 24-hour period. Coming from a very active 30-year-old to, hey, you might need a transplant. And I'm just like, I look at Megan, I just like start crying.
His doctors didn't know what had caused this sudden yet major problem. Again, Chris was just 30 years old then and healthy. Now his heart's left ventricle wasn't working. It's responsible for pumping oxygenated blood from the heart to the rest of the body. And the loss of this function can weaken the heart over time, sometimes causing the organ to swell.
They basically said when they looked at the x-ray, my heart almost looked like the size of if you picture a gallon of milk, that's what my heart got up to in size-wise.
How much blood a patient's heart is pumping out is measured with something called the ejection fraction. Anything below 40% is labeled as heart failure. Chris was hovering right around that line. He stayed in the hospital for 2 weeks, then he was sent home with something called a life vest, a device to monitor his ejection fraction. Things seemed to stabilize for a while, but weeks later, when he was driving on the highway,
my ejection fraction almost fell down to roughly 5%. And I felt just a pain in the center of my chest. I couldn't keep anything down again. I didn't even have anything to spit up, but I just felt that bad. Come to find out, I was having a blood clot in the middle of my chest while driving down Route 95. I mean, I was fighting for my life at that point.
Chris called 911. And an ambulance took him to the hospital. First, the physicians put him on life support because he could no longer breathe on his own, and then they put him in a medically induced coma. Megan was at the hospital with him.
He had
you know, the breathing tube in with the machine next to him, and then he had this giant ECMO machine where you saw all these giant tubes of, you know, you saw the blood getting pushed around through his body, and he had these like little sensors on his head that would monitor his brain activity to make sure everything, you know, was still okay there. So, and a lot of it was covered by blankets because he really just had so many tubes coming out of him and machines, and it was overwhelming, to say the least.
Weeks went by, and Chris would just lie in the hospital bed. His family and Megan waited by his bedside, hoping that he'd recover, but their hope began to wear thin as Chris's health declined. Eventually, his doctors presented two options. Chris could either join the heart transplant list and wait for a new heart, or he could use a left ventricular assist device, known as an LVAD, to help his own heart pump blood. This was a tough decision, because when Chris first learned of his heart failure, he told Megan that he'd never want to live with a device like that. But time was running out, so Chris's family chose what they felt like was the best option, the LVAD. The doctors planned to give Chris the newest model available. It's called the HeartMate 3. It's a small device. It looks a little like the cap on your car's gas tank. It latches on to the left ventricle and forces the heart to contract and pump blood to the rest of the body. It's connected to a rechargeable battery by a cord, and patients often carry this battery in a backpack. LVAD patients don't typically have a pulse when using this device, but it does keep them alive. Chris's doctors now had to wait for the right moment to perform this surgery to implant the device.
They always talked about this window, right? He was very fragile, and like they had to kind of wait for the right window to make sure that he was strong enough.
Windows when Chris was doing better kept opening, but closing too quickly. And then he got pneumonia.
It was really hard. On Christmas, they literally said that they couldn't do the surgery because of his pneumonia. So, and I'm crying because that was the first time I think I cried the whole time for him. Because I thought they missed the window and, you know, I didn't know what they were going to do. So they pushed the surgery off.
2 days after Christmas, a window opened. Doctors took a risk and performed the surgery. And it was successful, but Chris was still really sick and fragile from pneumonia. So he stayed in a coma for a few weeks until his doctors thought he was strong enough.
I remember one of the first things I asked was like the day or time, or that was like one of the biggest shocks to me, was going to sleep in December and waking up in January. And like, I started crying because I was like, I miss Christmas, I miss New Year. Like, I know I do remember that point.
When Chris finally saw himself in the mirror, he felt like he was staring at a stranger.
During this whole process, I lost roughly 60 to 65 pounds. You would not recognize me during this process.
Chris stayed in the hospital, and his recovery moved slowly. He had trouble breathing. He couldn't walk, flex his hand too much, or even speak.
I brought like a whiteboard in because he started trying to like write again, and that's how he kind of verbalized with us for a while at a time.
So Chris started rehab. He had to learn how to use his entire body all over again.
The first like 2-3 days were just standing and trying to take a baby step.
And while Chris was taking his not so first steps, Megan was learning how to be his caregiver.
They gave us like this full binder of information about the HeartMate 3 and how like certain alarms would go off. Like, what does that mean? Like, what do I need to do? What does he need to do? I had to pass his dressing change.
She's talking about the exit site of the LVAD, which is very important. There is a cord that connects the device inside of Chris's body to the battery case outside of his body. The cord exits just a few inches beneath his chest, and it's actually the most complicated and tricky aspect of living with an LVAD.
The biggest concern in that area, since it's an open wound technically, is the risk of infection. So with those dressings, we roughly change them about once a week. It's a pretty detailed process. It took some time, but we've gotten into a very good groove.
Chris finally came home on Valentine's Day. He was welcomed with a dinner by his closest friends and family, and Megan was thrilled, but she was also worried.
It was a lot of unknown. I didn't really know what his limitations were. He didn't know what his limitations were. So we really just took it, like, everything with a grain of salt and just like, okay, what do you feel like doing today? Like, can you do this? Like, one step at a time, really, truly.
Progress was really slow, but Chris eventually regained his strength and mobility. He could reach for the TV remote or even walk up the staircase in their home. And Megan became a pro at changing Chris's LVAD dressing. So now, there was really just one more question. Could Chris go back to his normal life? Do the things he loved? Could he travel or attend a Sixers game?
We're not normal. Like, we're going to make this life as normal as we possibly can without anybody knowing how sick he is on a regular day basis.
Megan and Chris decided to test out this new life with an impromptu vacation. While Chris can't go swimming at the beach per se, maybe he could experience the most magical place on earth.
We'd always talked about, like, Disney's just a happy place, right? For adults, children, whoever it is, it's just a happy place. With the help of others, you know, I was able to, like, surprise him and be like, we're going to Disney World.
But getting there proved to be more difficult than they had imagined.
We're going through security and we get stopped by a bomb technician at Philadelphia Airport because he basically was like, I've never seen this before. So they ran their different tests. He had like these swabs and stuff. He was amazing. He was extremely, extremely nice. But you get a little intimidated when a guy comes up with like bomb technician on his shirt at the airport and you have these people looking at you and you're just like, what's going on?
They eventually made it to Disney World and learned a lot about how to travel with the LVAD. Today, after living with this device for more than 3 years, they are extremely happy that they chose the LVAD route because
life can go on because, I mean, it's a life-changing experience. There's a lot that goes into it. It is terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying, but it gets better.
For Chris and Megan, life truly has gotten better. They recently welcomed a baby girl named Logan. And they got engaged. Chris and Megan have flown 4 times since their Disney trip, and they've attended plenty of Sixers games in Philadelphia. Chris is not on the heart transplant list because some patients with his condition recover over time. He's still young, and he hopes his heart will regain the strength to pump blood without the device. Until then, he'll use the LVAD and live life to the fullest. The couple told me that no pulse, no problem is their MO.
Yeah, I have a backpack. I have this driveline coming out, but I'm doing things that I would normally be doing.
That story was reported by Nicole Curry.
Feeling my way through the darkness, guided by a beating heart.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and make sure you check out the new investigative series from The Pulse called Serum. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Marcus Biddle is our health equity fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Nicole Curry is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.